Today's Sonny Rollins Quartet with John Coltrane with Tenor Madness. Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane, of course, on tenor sax, Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones, the famous drummer. That was recorded, by the way, in 1956. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrace Lead. It's Wednesday, May the 8th, and in Washington, an explosive congressional hearing into the terrorist attack on a U.S. diplomatic outpost in Benghazi, Libya, on September the 11th last year, is underway. In Cleveland, Ohio, a community celebrates the homecoming of three women abducted as teenagers 10 years ago and held captive by three middle-aged brothers. Of course, we'll be following these stories in our very own unique way. But today, we're focusing on President Obama's cash-flush cabinet, cash-cow politics, and cash-strapped budget. President Obama's cabinet remains seven slots short of a full team. He certainly won't win any awards for diversity, his cabinet having fewer African Americans and Latinos than President Clinton did 20 years ago. But that doesn't matter. This time around, the lame duck president is all about his pledge of allegiance to corporate and moneyed America. His cabinet appointees and nominees reflect his due diligence. Vivica Novak is the editorial and communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C. The center is the nation's premier research group that tracks money in U.S. politics and its effect on elections and public policy. And she joins us now. Thank you, Vivica, for being with us today.
It's good to be with you, Utrice.
Thank you so much. You and others at the center have been tracking not just the diversity of the president's cabinet, but also a peculiar trait that his selected members seem to share, and that is links to big money, and sometimes they don't even need the links. They have the big money themselves. Tell us about that.
Well, some of Obama's cabinet members, and I guess the most striking example would be his nominee to be the Secretary of Commerce, Penny Pritzker, they certainly have very high net worths. The Center for Responsive Politics tracks and follows the financial disclosure statements that members of the cabinet are required to file. Nominees are required to file. Lawmakers are required to file. So we kind of rank them. And the frustrating thing about these financial disclosure statements is, for instance, right now, the most recent ones that we have been able to crunch are for covering the year 2011. But so some of these obvious cabinet members are obviously no longer there. But Penny Pritzker is, I guess, brings a little diversity to the cabinet because she is a woman, but she is also a billionaire and one of the richest women in the world. And she, if she's confirmed, she would be the by far the wealthiest of his cabinet nominees, with John Kerry coming in second. In the Senate in 2011, John Kerry was the wealthiest member of that body.
Well, what does this suggest about, is this, from the Senate's point of view, a marked departure from the composition of the cabinet, the standard, if I were to use the word in a very generic and loose way, the standard composition of the president's cabinet? Is it different in the sense that you have so many people given these positions who seem to, they didn't come from government, as it were, but they are from the corporate world? Is this a remarkably different administration in that sense?
I don't think it's all that different. We haven't gone back and compared, but I certainly, I'm sure you remember, too, that presidents in our lifetime have had cabinet members often not coming from the ranks of government, but coming from industry, coming from labor, coming from other areas, and coming from Congress, of course, where, you know, a lot of members of Congress are quite wealthy, but some are not at all. So it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, just looking at this administration, the vice president himself has a very, very low net worth. He really has hardly any money. So it's, you know, it's not exactly representative, I guess, to say that they are all from this sort of world of privilege and wealth.
Prior to the nomination of Penny Pritzker as Commerce Secretary, she also had very strong political ties, she and her ability to bundle. Could you explain that concept and how it is that she might have been courted by President Obama? What is behind it?
Well, they're both from Chicago. She got to know him there. And she's been a benefactor of his since early in his national political career. Bundling, the concept is, since individuals can't give more than a certain amount to any one candidate, and in 2012, for instance, it was $2,500 that any one person could give to a candidate per election, so $2,500 for the primary and the same for the general, so $5,000 total. But that's, you know, to us, that might be a lot, but to some people, it's not that much. They might want to help more. And so they will go out and talk to their friends, and they will round up more money, and they will bundle it together and give it to the campaign, you know, as a lump sum bundled by that person. So Penny Pritzker in 2012, she was a bundler collecting at least $500,000, and we don't know how much more. It could have been much more than that. And she was also the co-chair of Obama's campaign that year. And she was the finance chair for his 2008 campaign, which meant that she really, you know, was beating the bushes trying to help deliver money for him because, as you may remember, he decided not to accept public financing that year. And then this year it was a given that he wouldn't this last year. But it was kind of a big deal in 2008. And she bundled between $200,000 and $500,000 for Obama in 2008. But again, she was kind of in charge of the whole financial operation.
What does this say about the state of politics? I mean, when these things happen, in any other country, I would imagine there would be such an incredible outcry that even before such a decision is made, the president would probably be reticent to do it. But when you look at the cabinet, and I mean, people have, and this is just the estimates, they're not compelled to say exactly how much money they have, exactly the, you know, the total of their assets. But when you have, for example, you talked about John Kerry after Ms. Pritzker would be the second most, the second richest member on the cabinet. He's been pretty rich in the Senate, too. What is the relationship between money? What is it about money? And in the last several years, there's a sense that it is the thing that gets attention. It is the way to go. These folks have money, and it is now that they could buy their way into situations that would ultimately prove to be very advantageous to them. Should people be concerned about this trend becoming so clear under Obama as opposed to previous administrations? Yes, you did have people from outside of government, but the sheer number of people who are millionaires and now a billionaire in office does have a disquieting effect, I think, on working people.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, our organization, we're a research group, so we don't take a position on really whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. We do advocate for transparency, so we think that the personal financial disclosure statements that are required are very important. We do think that they should be required to be more specific because they only have to list their assets in these broad ranges. But, you know, certainly from a voter's point of view or the public's point of view, you could argue that perhaps those who are up at the 1% level might not be able to relate to the average person out there. So for some, that might be a reason for concern. Now, it's kind of a two-way street. To run for office these days costs so much money. And members of Congress don't like that, frankly. They have to spend hours and hours every day making phone calls, trying to raise money, making cold calls, you know, leaning on their friends. It's not a good situation, and sure, it lends itself to people who might try to take advantage of the situation. So it's kind of a vicious circle that we've got going here, and you know, it's probably not the way to go in the end. I don't know at what point maybe the balance is tipped, but apparently we haven't gotten there yet. Campaign finance reform is not an issue that is very high on the priorities list for most individuals out there. In fact, it was next to last in a recent ranking I saw from the Pew Polling Center. And the only thing that did worse than campaign finance on that list was climate change, which is also kind of interesting. But it's difficult to get any sort of critical mass going for any possible changes.
Michael Froman was tapped by President Obama for the slot of U.S. Trade Representative. How does he look money-wise?
Well, not nearly as wealthy as Penny Pritzker. He was a Harvard Law School classmate of the president. He was also a bundler for Obama's 2008 campaign. And he raised between $200,000 and $500,000. He has been in government, but was before 2009 when he came to the White House. He was a managing director at Citigroup, so was doing pretty well financially.
Again, I'm picking up the keywords into the bundler. And we have the corporate designation. This is kind of troubling. I know your organization does not make any judgments with regard to that. It simply just tracks the influence of money and looking for transparency. But somewhere along the line, it should cause a great deal of concern that so many of the president's cabinet, so many members of the cabinet, including the nominees and those waiting for confirmation, have this decidedly corporate profile. And one wonders whether, given the history of such people, they ran businesses or they were part of huge international conglomerates that did billions and billions of dollars. In the case of Michael Froman, for example, coming from an international corporation that had a very troubled history with respect to the bailout and so forth, it should trouble people in the interest of, quote, democracy, unquote, that we have a larger than usual representation from this part of the world, and making policy for people. And you can't see the connection between their experience, their previous experience, with what they are expected to do in terms of their function if validated for the positions that the president has nominated them for. There's a very major disconnect there.
Well, you know, that's a judgment, I think, for the public. You can certainly find examples to the contrary. Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of DHS, is not a wealthy woman. Ray LaHood, the outgoing Transportation Secretary, really, really not a wealthy man. And the incoming, the mayor of Charlotte, who's been nominated to be the incoming head of DOT, is also not a wealthy person. So we certainly, even Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, not really particularly wealthy. So you see, you have examples to the contrary, and I would also say that the Secretary of Commerce, more than any other cabinet position, is one that is often filled by somebody who has done very well in the world.
Well, great. Thanks a lot for being with us today again, Viveka. Thank you for joining us today.
It's good to be with you. Take care.
Thank you. Well, of course, the organization is simply interested in finding out where the money is. A person is nominated, they track it down, and that's it. They are nonpartisan. That's how they're chartered, as a nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization. And that's the work that they do. But we know enough to suggest that the president's administration has more than a copious supply of people who come out of the corporate world and big time money. I mean, when you have a billionaire who is in charge of commerce and who comes out of a history of real estate, heir to the Hyatt Hotels Corporation, major board memberships, you certainly are making the case, and I'm just saying this because it's where we're going to go in our discussion, you're making the case that people should be automatically suspicious of government's policy making, because it is not likely, because when these people are functioning at this level, the network that they have is in fact that 1% of America. That's who they represent officially. The fact that this president could only see Harvard people, for the most part, and very, very wealthy people, and the people who are coming in are people who have done what? They've raised money for him. Big money. They've raised money for him. His intention, as he said, his stated intention, is to make sure that the Democratic Party not only prevails, but prevails in the majority this next election cycle in 2014, next year, when the congressional races are to be run. And you can't help but say this is a kind of pay-to-play kind of thing, isn't it? This is a kind of situation where the more money you have, the easier access you have. Not only do you have influence, you have the actual hands on the throttle and brake of government. And this president is opening the door, flinging it wide open. These are my people. He's a lame duck president. He doesn't have to care about what people think. That's none of his business. He's about making his pledge to the constituency that is most important to him, and that is the people with money. Money. So when you take a look at the Obama administration and you see how very out of whack the administration seems to be with the logical issues that should be preoccupying the administration, you can see why. It is, for example, people have been telling President Obama the number one priority, I've said it here 500 million times, the number one priority is jobs. The number one priority is jobs. Yeah, well, that's a working class view. But that's not the view of his administration or of the president himself. Because the constituency that he reports to doesn't see it that way. If you have full employment, then you have a thing they do not desire, and that is people will be earning real wages. That's not desirable. The way people become wealthy is their profit margins are much greater than the wages that they're paying. So if they belong to that club, it will be an extraordinary thing for them to depart from the philosophy that their wealth is directly related to the suffering of large numbers of people. That's basic philosophy from the wealthy group. They became wealthy by managing the degree to which salaries are somehow linked to a decent quality of life for working people. But I'm happy that I have people that I could talk to, and one of them is going to be coming on right now. His name is Doug Kenwood. Doug is the editor of the Left. Doug is the editor of the Left Business Observer, and he hosts Behind the News, which originates on KPFA, the Pacifica station in California, and is heard on 7 other stations around the country and worldwide on the web. Doug, thanks for being with us today.
Hello. Long time.
Long time. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine. Thank you, Doug. Listen, we were just talking about the overrepresentation of moneyed interests on the Obama cabinet, or in the Obama cabinet, and the philosophy within the world of money, that money profits have a relationship with the degree to which wages are strictly controlled, because that's what increases the profit margin for the 1% of America that is ridiculously wealthy. Before you go into your discussion today, and we'll be talking with Doug on what's coming next, and that is part of this discussion, which is austerity. Yes. The president is about to swing the axe. I've been telling you, he's going to swing it pretty hard. But let's talk about, if you can give us a little insight, a little bit of a connection between what would a cabinet with such a heavy representation of people from the world of wealth, can they or will they be trusted to make sane, humane, and equitable policies that would benefit the working class people?
Well, I guess every now and then you will find a very rich person who is sane and equitable, what was the third word you used? They're rare, and they're certainly not to be found in large numbers in the Obama administration. It was almost from the first minute he took office by appointing Tim Geithner as Secretary of the Treasury. He telegraphed his intentions to Wall Street that he was going to not upset the apple cart, and he has governed pretty much along those lines. I know that some people on Wall Street think he's some sort of secret socialist or something, but a lot of those people are pretty demented. I think he's made it very, very clear that he is not going to do anything to step on their toes. Very early in his term, he gave a speech, I believe, in Cooper Union in New York City, and called some bankers fat cats, which is about the most radical thing he's said or done in relation to Wall Street. They've never forgiven him for that. I mean, they have very thin skins, these characters. If they run into a bit of trouble, they're very quick to go to the government to look for a bailout. But otherwise, they want to be treated with deference. They want to be genuflected to. As an old friend of mine said, rich people these days don't want to pay taxes. They want to be paid tribute. And I think she was really onto something with that.
And it's true. It is absolutely true. But tell us about what's looming in the wings. What is a president going to do with respect to this austerity budget?
Well, we basically have two choices now between the two parties. One is austerity light and one is austerity heavy. The Republicans are very clear on what they'd like to do. In their ideal world, they would like to privatize Social Security and Medicare and eliminate all but the most minimal income supports to people who are poor, unemployed, or disabled. That's the maximal approach. Now, next to that, the Democrats present themselves as a sane alternative, which means a lighter version of all those things. Obama has made it clear. He gave a speech in, I believe, 2007 to the Hamilton Project. The Hamilton Project was a group founded by Robert Rubin, who was the Treasury Secretary under Clinton, who was a former co-chair of Goldman Sachs. People like that, and surrounded by folks like Pete Peterson, former Commerce Secretary under Nixon, big private equity guy in Wall Street. Their love for many, many years has been, or their passion for many, many years has been to cut Social Security and Medicare, and Medicaid as well. Obama gave them a very loving speech in 2007. About how he was pretty much down with their agenda. And then during the 2008 campaign, he was a little subtle about it, a little diplomatic, but he made it pretty clear that he was interested in that agenda. And almost immediately on taking office in 2009, he or his people, it's not clear which, spoke to David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, and made it very clear that they were going to once the worst of the recession was over in 2009, they were going to turn their attention to long-term cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the so-called entitlements. And this was, I believe, March 2009. He came into office, with this a large margin and control of both houses of Congress, high approval ratings in the polls, and a general mood among the population that we had had enough of the pampering of the rich and the feeding of the military machine and all that sort of thing that characterized the Bush era. It was plain that the population was sick of that and voted for him to have a real change of direction from those priorities. He was in a very strong political position at that point to change the conversation in a different direction. He made it clear he did not want to. He made it clear in March 2009 that he really wanted to get the budget under control, as they say, and that meant cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It was a lighter version of the Republican agenda, but it's been what he's been wanting to do for a long time. So it's a lot of liberals and Democrats will blame the Republicans for this, but it's pretty clear that these are Obama's preferences as well. So what I think we're going to face is, we've had this sequester take effect. So we have this now, most people haven't really thought about it very much. So we've seen these fairly modest cuts to a lot of domestic spending. We're seeing Meals on Wheels programs being cut, clinics being cut, but at the margins. I mean, not deep, massive cuts. But this has become the new baseline. And from there, we're going to see more of that. And I think as the year goes on, there will be pressures to have various ways of cutting Social Security and Medicare. Now, the president has endorsed a subtle cut to Social Security by changing the price index by which cost of living adjustments are calculated. But they're also going to see cuts to Medicare in the coming months. And I don't know. I suspect people, a lot of Democrats are so afraid of the Republicans that they'll agree to anything that the administration proposes. So it's going to be there's going to be some kind of deal, I suppose, unless the gridlock is so severe in Washington. There's going to be some kind of deal between austerity light and austerity heavy that's going to come up with austerity medium heavy.
Well, a lot of what the president is thinking is. His theories derive really from the Clinton administration. It goes as far back as that. When Clinton decided, he under cover of being a real nice guy, saxophone playing president, a liberal, progressive guy, he was busy putting into place the structure for cutting as he said, you know, the famous quote is ending welfare as we know it. And it was Clinton, my theory is, that who launched this whole move within the Democratic Party to distinguish that group of Democrats who really are conservatives. They're called now the Blue Dog Democrats. But Barack Obama should have had the common sense to see that in the end he would be losing, if only to get the respect and love and trust of the moneyed group. He's actually setting politics back several decades and making life almost intolerable for the people who are trenchantly poor. What is it about this man that nobody seems to be calling him out on from his base constituencies?
Well, I think we've got several things going on. One is, you know, this is the consensus of the American upper class, the American ruling class, the elite, the moneyed, the Wall Street people, have this consensus that we need to cut Social Security, Medicare, and rein in public spending, basically. We can't raise taxes on rich people. We can't have, you know, God knows, and some sort of ambitious job creation program or some kind of program to develop alternative energy so we don't cook the planet to death. All these things that need to be done just can't be done. So that is the consensus of, you know, the American upper class. Now, the pundits, of course, go along with this. This is the economists, the Bigfoot thinkers that get onto into the newspapers and the websites and the TV. This is their consensus as well. Now, along with that, we have, you know, an absolutely rabid Republican Party. I mean, I don't want to let the Democrats off the hook, but the Republican Party is just a reactionary and insane and horrifying thing. So that's, you know, what we've got on one side. But we have no countervailing power on the other. The labor movement is very, very weak. I think a lot of otherwise good folks have been disarmed by the fact that Obama is our first black president, so people cut him a lot of slack for that. A lot of liberals are, you know, so afraid that the alternative Republicans would be so much worse that they'll agree to anything that Obama proposes. And, you know, there's just no popular mobilization against this agenda. So you have this combination of an elite consensus and no popular mobilization against it. That will lead to austerity light or medium light or whatever it is we want to call it. Now, I think another factor is the personality of Obama himself. If we go back, you know, to the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt, this is a man who emerged from the upper class. And he had a great deal of confidence in himself to kick them around a bit. Of course, there were also, you know, the popular environment was different. We had, you know, all kinds of radical mobilizations and unions going on, fear of the Soviet Union, all kinds of things pushing at Roosevelt from the left. But he also had the confidence in his personality that allowed him to be a little more rebellious. And take on the orthodoxy. He gave a very famous speech in Madison Square Garden in 1936 in which he said, you know, never have the rich hated someone as much as they hate me. I welcome their hatred. Now, you can't imagine Obama saying anything like that. And I think it's because Obama is a guy who, you know, certainly didn't grow up in poverty, but he grew up in modest circumstances and was basically groomed by elites from the time he was very young. He went to a fancy school in Hawaii. Then he went to Ivy League colleges and then was embraced by elite foundations. And I think, unlike Roosevelt, who welcomed the hatred of the elite that hated him, I think Obama wants their love and wants their respect. I mean, he has, I think, a certain degree of desire for approval for the rich and powerful. You know, a couple of years ago, he described Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan as savvy businessmen. That's not the language that Roosevelt would have used towards people like that in his day. So I think that you have this combination of an elite consensus, the absence of any kind of popular pressure, plus the configuration of Obama's own personality, and you get this. Now, Obama is an extremely sophisticated, smart, well-read, thoughtful guy. So, you know, he knows what he's doing. I mean, the idea that he's sort of outclassed or outgunned by clever people or powerful people, this just doesn't hold water. I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
Well, I wonder if there might be something else going on here. I agree with what you're saying. I mean, I think that is widely accepted in the left of center community. But just the same, I wonder whether what President Obama will be doing before he leaves office is really erecting the architecture and making it far more solid for future Democrats. And for he's very concerned about the future of the Democratic Party. And it seems as if what he's attempting to do is literally to craft an approach of controlling the Democratic Party to give rise within the party of this conservative element. And in so doing, to neutralize the same element that exists in the Republican Party. So they would actually, at some point, there would be a convergence of interests, more so than there is now.
Well, my friend and guru on many things, Adolf Reed, said many years ago, actually, that he thought what was happening was that the Republicans were turning into a party of you know, extreme free marketeers and religious lunatics. And the Democratic Party then would become a kind of establishment centrist party, and that, you know, the liberals and such would just be forced to vote for them because there was nowhere else to go. I think Adolf was onto something with that. I think that's precisely what's happening. The Republican Party is clearly has a narrow base. They could certainly win elections, but you know they have a very narrow base demographically. It's mostly older white people who live in the South and the parts of the Midwest and the interior West. They've lost the coasts. They've lost the upper Midwest. They've lost a lot of young people. They've certainly lost a lot of non-white people. So you know, demographically and regionally, the Republican Party has a very, very narrow constituency. So what then the Democrats can say is, you know, we can take the votes of liberals and minorities for granted, and we can do whatever we want to because they've got nowhere else to go, and then we can, you know, do things that will please Wall Street and the Fortune 500 and get their money. And this has been a process that's been underway since, you know, the 80s, really. The Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which it was founded, I think, around 1984 or so. Can't remember exactly. But this has been their mission, to purge the party of its labor and civil rights constituencies. Or not purge them, but to neutralize their influence. Keep their votes, because they need the votes, but to neutralize the ideological effects, political effects, govern by and for a kind of, you know, very elite, not the rabid, insane crowd that the Republicans could govern on behalf of, or would govern on behalf of, but sort of the more responsible elites and the professional managerial class. That's who the Democrats have been moving towards for 20, 30 years. The Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, dissolved itself a couple of years ago because its mission was accomplished. They had this process that started, as you pointed out, under Clinton, now I think has come to fruition under Obama. And you know, this is the Democratic Party now. It is a party of a certain part of Wall Street, a certain part of the Fortune 500, and suburban and, you know, gentrified urban professional managerial class. That's what the Democratic Party is all about right now.
And it is evidenced within the party. We see the Progressive Caucus basically hinting publicly that they have issues with President Obama's policies. The Legislative Caucus, the Black Legislative Caucus, the Latino Legislative Caucus, they are bitter over a whole bunch of things that this president is doing, including ignoring them completely. So we are seeing within the party the movement toward that point that we are talking about, this conservatism within the Democratic Party. And here, Doug, is a question. One would assume that if the playing field were read right, by the a third party movement, if you will, or a third way of, I don't even want to say that. That's Clinton, isn't it? He said the third way.
Clinton and Tony Blair, that was their thing.
The third way. I don't want to say that. Why isn't it that we don't seem to have the muscle within another movement, an alternative movement that seems to make sense, much more sense than Obama is making now and the Democratic Party, and certainly more than the Republican Party is making, with respect to the ideological preferences for groups that are so large that could ostensibly support a movement that would counter where the Democratic Party is going under Obama?
Well, the American system is really set up to make it very difficult for a third party to get anywhere. The structure of our elections, the Electoral College, the so-called first-past-the-post system, that, you know, there's no representation for, it's very difficult to get representation for minority views in state legislatures, in the Congress, and certainly at the presidential level. If you go back and read the writings of Madison and the rest of the founding fathers, they were very careful. They knew what they were doing. They wanted to make it difficult, precisely that way, for what they viewed as a dangerous faction tendencies. Madison in the Federalist Paper number 10 made it very clear that they were setting up this constitutional system basically to guarantee the security of rich people and to make it very difficult for the popular majorities to get together and take some of their money away from them. So this is the American system. It's quite consciously crafted by a bunch of 18th century elites, good number of them slave owners. They knew what they were doing, and it was a very ingenious system from their point of view, because it's just really, really difficult to get a third party going. And then you add to this the increasing power of money in politics, the narrowing of access in the media, and it's really hard to get the thing going. I think what you need, we need to change that to some degree is movements that are not necessarily oriented towards electoral politics, that are pushing an agenda, whether it's living wage legislation or efforts to organize fast food workers, or people organizing around healthcare finance, single payer. Those sorts of issue-oriented things might be more a more promising route than trying to develop a third party, because third parties have done very badly in American history. Now, sometimes say third parties will pop up and change the political discourse. So we saw that in the populist parties, the populist movement in the late 19th century, or people like socialists like Norman Thomas and Eugene Debs did manage to, even though they never won elective office, did manage to change the conversation. So there is, I'm not going to say that third parties are hopeless, but it's very, very difficult to get these things going.
And even if they become successful at that level in terms of popular appeal, they still have to contend with the architecture of the Congress and of the Senate. And that is wholly owned by the two-party system, so they'll be squeezed out of things.
The Senate is just an outrage. I mean, everything about the Senate stinks. It is the whole structure of it, in which a handful of states have as much representation. I can't remember these numbers exactly, but the 10 least populous states have 20 senators together, and they still have less population than California does. So the whole structure of the Senate is an abomination. But again, that was very, very deliberate. Washington, I believe, was said to Jefferson that the Senate was meant to act like a saucer to cool hot tea. It was quite consciously set up as a check on popular power. So, whenever people lament these things, they sometimes forget the fact that this is a feature, not a bug, as they say in the computer business.
Well, never mind the fact that it is considered to be poor etiquette to pour your tea into a saucer to cool it.
Yes, well, that was the 18th century.
But let's talk about the immediate future, where Barack Obama is right now. He's about to take yet another, campaign on the road, and this one supposedly is about jobs, not about creating jobs, not about his plan for jobs, but about his idea about how jobs should be created. The president has not yet, despite the fact that over and over and over again people have been saying the issue is jobs, 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 he's going to be, I think, the first stop on this campaign that he's going to do is, I think, in Las Vegas, is it? And he's going to be talking, I'm not sure if it's Las Vegas, but somewhere there. He's going to be talking about the concept of the kinds of jobs that ought to exist. He does not yet have a plan. What is going to happen? Let's talk about what you see, Doug, as what would unfold in the next several months toward the end of the year in terms of what this austerity plan would look like and who would be affected.
Well, you know, just first on the jobs question, he says a lot of things, but then there's no money there to make it happen, or very, very little. So, you know, it'd be great to have a lot of high-wage jobs and, you know, getting us all together and marching boldly into the future, but words aren't going to get us there. In that sense, he's very reminiscent of Clinton. I mean, I used to read the Clinton budget documents, in which he'd like the prose part of it, where it was all about how we're going to be investing in people and, you know, investing in the future and building the bridge to the 21st century. That was one of the things that they loved to say. And then you looked at the actual budget numbers, and the amounts of money were committed to these grand goals were almost immeasurably small. Then Obama's doing the same thing. And, of course, it's difficult to get this sort of thing through Congress. I understand all those practical difficulties. But being president, you do have a lot of power and visibility, and he could be up there changing the way we talk and think about things. That's one of the powers that people in high office have. Now, if you look back in the Reagan days, Reagan in his early time in office was very clear about making a major break with the way we had been doing things in the past. And he spoke very explicitly about that. That we can't go back to the old ways of doing things, the old discredited ways of doing things. We need a different approach. And he was very successful in changing the way people talk and think about these things. So the point where I think most people under the age of, 50 or 60 have no sense that there's any other way of approaching politics than what would they become useful in the post-Reagan era, or become conceivable in the post-Reagan era. So there's that. We do have an extremely serious jobs problem. You know, even if we're just talking about the jobs that were lost in the recession, we're still about 2 or 3 million short of regaining those, and that's not even accounting for population increase, and not accounting for the fact that enormous numbers of people have just dropped out of the workforce because they've given up the search for employment because it's hopeless. So, you know, we are maybe, I don't know, by a conservative estimate, or a reasonable estimate, about 10 million jobs short of where we should be. So that's a lot of jobs that we need. And the jobs that have been created in this recovery over the last couple of years have been disproportionately low wage with no benefits. So, you know, the quality of the jobs is really lacking, and the quantity of jobs is really lacking. Something should be done. We saw that when Obama took office in 2009, one of the better things he did was that stimulus package. And for all its flaws, for all its compromises and small numbers, it actually accomplished what it set out to accomplish. It did save us from falling into complete depression. So, but they never really took credit for it. They never said this worked. They never really said that this kind of stimulus spending actually accomplished its goals. They've been running away from it ever since. So now they're talking instead about balancing the budget, getting rid of the deficit. Now, because of the sequester and because of other budget deals and because of some degree of economic recovery, the budget deficit is shrinking and is nothing to get panicked about. Yet elites have been panicking about it, and the Obama administration has done nothing to challenge that panic, really. So what we're going to see, I think, as the year goes on, is our efforts to pare Medicare spending, to cut back on Social Security, and to cut back on Medicaid. Those, I think, are the principal areas of attack. The military budget did get cut somewhat because of the sequester, but certainly could be afforded to be cut a lot more, but we're not going to see any talk about that. And we're certainly not going to see talk about, you know, raising taxes on the richest 5% of the population. And again, I know that it's difficult to get these things through Congress, but the president has not really done anything to try to challenge the grip of austerity and the power of the rich in public discourse.
Well, Doug, this has been a fantastic conversation after 500 years of not connecting with each other. Glad that we found each other.
Yes, very good again. To be reunited.
But I really appreciate the insights that you bring and the way you understand it and can therefore translate it, because it makes sense. You know, it's not pie in the sky, you know, complex economic theory sounding, although it is, but you are explaining it in a way that people can make sense of what is going on. And that's really a fantastic service more than anything else that I can think of. So it removes the discussion from the boardrooms and the high and mighty places, and it makes it accessible to regular folk who should be understanding economics every day, the politics of economics. So I want to thank you. And I also am going to be issuing you more frequent invitations to to help us understand things the unique way that you do it.
All right, well, thank you for the kind words, and happy to come back sometime.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Well, these discussions are meant to be primers, if you will, for things that we are seeing unfolding before our eyes. So when we get into these discussions, you will have a point of reference that makes sense. And nothing surprises. You know, we have this feeling that, there's a level of understanding that we don't have just because we can't have it. You know, it's way beyond our means, way beyond our ability to understand. Absolutely not. This president is dangerous, because this president is picking up from where Bill Clinton, I've said it from the beginning, and I'm holding to it, some of the most, quote, liberal policies and politicians, unquote, are also some of the most lethal to equality in the United States. We're not just talking about policy for policy's sake. We're talking about the access people should have in this day and time to the strategic resources of a society because they have made the requisite investment. And one of the strategic resources is employment, which is key to a whole bunch of equality. This president brought into power for a second term. He's not in his first term. He's in a second term, and we have had no real response to the issues defined by his core constituencies as being maximally important. He's following another agenda. He's handled by a whole other permanent set of interests that we don't see. But we see the response, and therefore we can intuit what the stimulus is, and we know it's not good. So that brings us to the end of our program today. Let's join with each other tomorrow. We have Bill Blum, who's going to be with us, and we'll be talking about other stories unfolding in Congress today. Reach me at LeadStories, LeidStories@gmail.com. Reach me also at Facebook, and continue the conversation there. Until then, I really cherish the pleasure of your company. Bye-bye.